Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. Today's guest is Kate Howard, Portfolio Manager of the Fidelity Australian Opportunities Fund, which she's managed since inception nearly 8 years ago. She received the Lonsec Rising Star Award in 2016 and the Women in Financial Services Investment Manager of the Year Award in 2015. In this episode, we discuss what makes a great company. She shares two ASX-listed companies that are making it big overseas. And we discuss a strange anomaly that's been created by the combination of low rates, easy money, and passive investing. As always, if you're loving The Rules of Investing, then why not tell someone about it? Pick your favourite episode and send it to a friend, or just head on over to Apple Podcasts and hit subscribe. Either way, you're helping to increase the profile of the podcast, and therefore the quality of the guests that I can bring to you. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Kate, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Let's start talking a bit about your background. I'm curious to learn a bit about how you came to be where you are today. I see a lot of quite diverse backgrounds coming into funds management, but I haven't actually seen someone move from investor relations to portfolio management before. Could you explain what drove that move? What was it that really appealed to you about managing investments for people?
Oh, look, the simplest answer is that I thought it would be a lot more fun to be asking the questions than answering the questions. But more seriously, when I look back on my career, the thread that pulls it all together is a fascination with what makes a great company. I did my MBA at the University of Chicago to understand how to analyze that. I went from there into the Boston Consulting Group to work on helping to make companies better. And then I moved over into a corporate role, so working on the inside. And then I discovered that there was this world of portfolio management where I could explore the same question, what makes a great company, but do it with a lot more breadth. And rather than being working just inside one company, I could look at a whole range of companies right across the economy. And that was really just too good to pass up. So I moved across to AMP Capital and then joined Fidelity in 2004. And I have to say my expectations have been met. It is just so interesting to come into work every day to learn how the world has changed, how innovation is happening, how companies are responding to disruption, and then overlaying that with how much of that is reflected in individual share prices and where is there a mispricing that you can take advantage of. There's just no job that's more interesting, I think.
Let's stay on that topic for a second. You just said something that I think really caught my interest, which is you were fascinated in learning what makes a great company. I'm just curious if you could maybe share with us some of the lessons that you've got, you know, along that journey, maybe something you picked up while, you know, before you got into portfolio management, or even something that you've learned since then. What are some of those elements that are, you think make a great company that maybe aren't fully widely appreciated?
Well, I think the fundamentals of it are the economics of the business. And, you know, your perfect company is one that can generate high returns off of a small capital base and can then reinvest those excess returns into growing the capital base. And so they can have high incremental returns. Previously, there weren't too many companies that could do that. You might have a company that generated high returns, maybe like a Procter & Gamble or a Nike, but to grow their business, they had to reinvest in kind of building more factories to sell more widgets. Now we've actually got software companies where they generate high returns, but the reinvestment into software and being able to sell twice as much software doesn't require the capital intensity of building new sites of physical production. So, you know, it's really interesting to me that we're seeing more of these sorts of businesses recently than we ever have before. There are more better businesses out there than there were previously.
Yeah, that's quite fascinating because you hear a lot of people complaining about the high valuations today, which I'm sure we're going to touch on later. But I don't think a lot of people consider that maybe there are just better businesses out there than we have had before. I'll be interested when we get to that to hear if you think if that's a factor in it all as well. But before we go there, why don't you tell us a bit about some investments you've made in the past? What were, say, the best and the worst investments you've made, and which one did you learn more from?
Mm. So the best investment I've made is A2 Milk. I started looking at A2 Milk just around the time when it was listing in Australia. It had been listed in New Zealand, and it was listing in Australia. And when it listed here, the stock had been sold off in New Zealand, so it came at quite a low valuation. The company was already the number one brand of milk sold in Australia, and it was quite profitable because it sold at about double the price of generic milk. But it was plowing all of that back into launching an infant formula business for China and then doing fresh milk in the US and the UK. And it was investing so much that it made itself unprofitable, kind of, you know, Uber style. And because of that, I think people looked at it and thought, it's this weird milk company. They've got some science claim about the milk, but no one really knows if there's any substance to it. And they're unprofitable, so, you know, maybe this whole thing won't come together. The work that we did on it showed that, you know, on the contrary, there clearly was a segment of the market that was very interested in buying into A2. And in some ways, we thought the analogy was with organic food, you know, or gluten-free. You know, there might be a subset of the population that can kind of medically prove they need these foods, but there's a much, much larger part of the population who is happy to pay a premium to buy these foods, even if the science backing them, you know, is not clear cut. So we never thought that verifying the science behind A2 was the critical part, as long as there were enough consumers out there that believed in the proposition. So we invested, it was about 50 cents when it listed in Australia, and it got really highly valued, and we sold out above $7. So that was a really good return. And it really just was a case, you know, as I was saying earlier, about a great business making great returns and then being able to reinvest those to grow and compound its value. And the cash flows coming out of that business now have just grown tremendously. So that was a wonderful business and kind of confirmed that you can make the best returns when you can identify a really high quality business that the market doesn't perceive that way to begin with. So, you know, once everyone knows what a great business it is, there's less of an opportunity because the valuation that you're buying in at will be a lot higher. The one that was the worst one, I'd have to say, was the only stock I've owned that's gone to zero. And that was RCR Tomlinson, which is a contractor. And we thought they were on the right side of the industry because their contracting business was being focused on renewables and mostly on solar farms, installing solar farms. But what happened was they were rolling out solar farms, and solar farms are really just laying down a big concrete pad and then erecting all of the solar panels on top of them. And the pads that they were putting in suffered from subsidence. The ground started to move, and so you weren't able to put the solar panels on there properly with the right alignment. So all of a sudden, there was this big contingent liability that popped up on the balance sheet that then became a real liability, and then before you knew it, the company was insolvent. Now, a couple of weeks before they called in the administrators, they raised capital. And at that point, we thought that with a bit more capital, the company would make it through. And we took comfort from the fact that individual board members on that business personally put their money into that capital raise. But it was only a matter of weeks after that that the company was gone, which I guess the lesson learned out of that is it's not good enough to just look at the balance sheet as it presents in the financial accounts. You've also got to have some understanding of the potential for contingent liabilities to suddenly materialize and overwhelm the asset base. And that, you know, when you're trying to assess that, even company insiders might not have a really good understanding of that. So that was a real disappointment. The business just went down so quickly that we weren't able to exit that in time.
Yeah, it's always frustrating when you find that the information that you're presented with is not accurate, and you realize that there may not have been a lot that you could do to really verify it. I mean, at the end of the day, we rely on the ASX and the regulators to ensure that the information is accurate. And it's probably, especially for an individual investor, it becomes very difficult to verify beyond what they say. So yeah, it's a tough situation.
I think we're fortunate in that the ASX is a very activist stock exchange, and they do pride themselves on having rigorous listing standards. They very clearly do not want to be a light touch market and attract dubious listings. So you've got that going for you, where you have had questions arise. The ASX will offer revised guidance notes to continually lift the standards of disclosures in Australia. And if there's something that they think has any hint of not being accurate, they will query it and follow it up. So, you know, we're fortunate that the disclosure standards in Australia are very high quality. But it doesn't save you from bad businesses.
No. I think about the only thing you can do there is diversify.
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit about the bigger picture and the investment environment today. We're in a world where rates are low, inflation is low, and you know, we've had continual rate cutting and monetary easing around the world. If we continue down this path that we've been on, do you think it will remain supportive of equities, or is there a point where all of this low rates and, for lack of a better term, money printing, does it start to bite eventually?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. If you go back to the financial crisis really was an issue with too much debt. And then the way we've tried to address that is really by adding more debt. So in the financial economy, you've got this issue of a really large debt buildup, which Ray Dalio calls the long-term debt cycle, where debt levels are higher than they've been for 100 years. And as a response to that, policymakers have introduced a lot of policy distortions, quantitative easing, so aggressive forms of monetary policy. That's all going on in the financial economy. And in the financial economy, QE is doing a great job. It's getting people to invest. It's forcing people to invest by forcing investors to move out the risk curve and back more and more speculative things in an attempt to try to get a return. The problem is that QE has never really had much traction in the real economy. So what we're getting as this plays out is the financial economy is getting pumped up more and more. Pretty much all asset prices in the world have gone up over the past decade. So if you've been on the right side of that, where you're an asset owner or someone who has access to borrowing funds at a really low rate, you're doing really, really well, and you're really growing your asset base at a fast clip. But if you are one of the rest of the population, you know, which is by number, you know, more of them who are just living and working and earning and paying bills in the real economy, then things have not gotten any better for you in a decade. Real wages have been pretty stagnant. Technological disruption has upended a lot of jobs. And so the real impact of all of these policies has been to increase the divide between the financial economy and the real economy. So in answer to your question, I think low rates and low growth are fine on the financial economy side. I think eventually they play out. The issue will be the widening gap with the experience of most people in the real economy, where things haven't gotten better. And in fact, you know, trying to buy core assets like a home to live in have just gotten out of reach. looking ahead, we're probably going to keep the party going. So as monetary policy gets played out, we'll probably move into fiscal policy and unconventional fiscal policy with things like modern monetary theory. And so I think that will be an attempt to rebalance things towards the real economy and towards the people who are workers more than asset owners. Then that's when you might start to see things bite. If we get significant financial redistribution, if you actually get higher tax rates, those will then start to bite into the value of the assets that have been doing so well in the financial economy.
Of course, a lot of that money from central bank is around the world is causing some pretty strange and unusual and unexpected effects. What are some of the unexpected effects that you're actually seeing from this situation?
Well, quantitative easing was expressly designed to make safe assets like long-dated treasury government bonds unattractive and to force people to then buy more risky assets to get some kind of a yield. So it's created what you can think of as an ugly contest among asset classes. So first, really safe long-dated government bonds are made ugly, then shorter-term government bonds are made ugly, corporate bonds are made ugly, and so investors have to keep going up the risk curve. If you think about it in practical terms, if you're a retiree and you have a lot of your money in a term deposit, when the time comes for that to roll, you get sticker shock when you look at what the bank is offering you. It's next to nothing. And so you say, well, I can't live off of the return I get off of a term deposit. Maybe I need to buy into an unlisted property fund. Maybe I need to buy into some, you know, listed hybrids. Now, you know, these are assets that are delivering a return, but they're much higher risk than a term deposit. So we're getting this cascading of overvaluation just rolling through all asset classes in the world. You can see that bonds are now, you know, when you see bonds at very low yields or even negative yields, that the flip side of that for bond pricing is that bond prices, it'd be the highest they've been in over 30 years. At the same time, equity markets are in a lot of cases running at new highs, and equity valuations in some cases are starting to get stretched. Property prices have been going up, collectibles, art, all of those sorts of assets are also pretty strongly bid. The interesting thing when you look around and say, where is there a sense of price discipline of what people are prepared to pay? There is one little subset, and this is a bit self-serving, but in this decade-long bull market in everything, the one part of the financial economy that's been in its own private bear market is active management, especially active equity management. So where you're starting to see that, so scarcity gives some power. When there's a lot of money chasing after assets, then the power is all with the seller of the assets and the price is going to be high. So you've got a lot of overvalued assets in private equity hands that want to have an exit strategy of listing onto stock markets. And then you've got stock markets that have been bid up by the flow of passive and algorithmic and ETF funds coming into the market. But the only way to link those two is through an IPO process. And the IPOs are still dominated by active managers. So you have to get active managers to agree to pay the valuation that you want to see for your asset coming out of private equity hands. And as we've seen, famously, there have been some large issues in the US that got listed and have then underperformed. You've had some proposed listings that have failed. So I think this is where you're seeing the power and the discipline and the restraint that comes from active managers. You know, there's just not that much money in active management anymore compared to the quantity of companies in private equity hands that want to make it onto listed markets. So I think that's an interesting kind of subset to watch.
Yeah, it is certainly an interesting one. There's been a number of very high profile companies that have failed to make it to the markets in the last year or so. It'll be fascinating to see how that plays out and whether that trend continues. Certainly, I'm sure the owners of Latitude Financial thought that they could get their IPO to market, but I think that's actually failed twice now, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right.
But of course, the other effect that which you alluded to there that all this money is having is to push up the price of listed stocks. How do you, or can you even get comfortable paying the kind of increased prices that we're seeing for prices on public markets?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. So this is a question of how do you survive when markets get extended? I think a lot of what's driving it now is this shift of money through passive and ETF and algorithmic funds that are not really looking at price versus value. Previously, pretty much anyone buying shares, whether they were an institutional investor or a retail investor, they all had some notion of price versus value, and a stock was undervalued or overvalued, and therefore you would buy it or you would sell it. Whereas now there's so much money that is just trading on momentum or low volatility, a range of different factors, where price doesn't really seem to factor into it. So that presents dilemmas for the thoughtful investor. So I have a couple of approaches to that. One is to look for really good companies that do deserve higher valuations, and they might be overvalued, but because they're compounding their value, because they're these great businesses that have high returns and can then reinvest those returns, they're compounding their value. So their underlying value is growing at a pretty fast rate. So even if they're overvalued today, you can earn into that over a couple of years. And that's a much better proposition than overpaying for an asset where the value is not going to grow at a fast clip. I think you need to be very careful there. So the first thing is, if you're going to be a bit more lenient on the valuation you're prepared to pay, make sure that time is your friend and that you at least have a hope of earning into it through time. And then I think you want to take the other side of that. There are some assets, you know, much like in 99, where you had the dot-com and everything became bifurcated into old economy and new economy, and the new economy stocks did really, really well for about 18 months, and then there was a big reversal, and suddenly it was the old economy, the unloved old economy stocks, that became favored just because they were so cheap and there was so little expectation in their share price. So, you know, there are stocks out there in the Australian market, believe it or not, where the PE that they're trading on is the same as their free cash flow yield. So, you know, 9x PE, 9x free cash flow yield. Why is that? Well, because they're in an industry that the market thinks is being disrupted. They're on the wrong side of history, and, you know, someone with a piece of software is coming and disrupting their business model. But, you know, at that point, the expectations in some of the disruptors is overplayed, and the expectations in some of the, you know, old economy companies is underplayed, and you can actually buy into some pretty solid cash flow streams at a very reduced rate. So I think you know, it's helpful to make sure you've got something on both sides of the equation.
Well, let's talk about one of those old economy stocks. I understand that Oil Search is one of your larger overweight positions, but on the other side of that, Woodside, which is obviously also another Australian oil and gas producer, is one of your biggest underweight positions. Could you explain your view behind these, and, you know, do you have a view on oil and gas, or is it based on the fundamentals of the business?
Yeah, so to make sense of that, I kind of have to explain a bit of my approach to portfolio construction. Your job as the portfolio manager is to put risk into the portfolio where you have an edge, so where the odds are better than 50-50. And if something is just a 50-50 question, then it's really not going to add alpha to the portfolio. It's just going to add volatility. So I think of a stack of risk. And at the top, you've got things like macro risk. You know, is the trade war going to be over quickly, or is it going to be long and involved? Are stocks going to outperform bonds? Is inflation going to go up or down? All of these kind of macro questions, which I don't think I have an edge on. Fidelity as a firm, we don't really focus on those and think we have an edge. You've got to break it down to the stock level, and that's where we spend our time and energy with our team of analysts here and around the world, where we feel that we can uncover differences at the stock level. So when I'm putting the portfolio together, I want to neutralize out the macro risk, the sector risk, the style risk, and really bring it down so that the majority of the risk in the portfolio is at that stock level. Now, ironically, what that means is that you want to keep things fairly neutral at the sector level or the industry group level. So when I look at a sector like energy, which is pretty large in our market, I might have a view on oil price or the path of oil production for the future, but I don't really think it's a robust enough view to be the basis for investing. So I'm going to stay broadly neutral on that space. And within that, I want to own something that I think is going to do better than the other alternatives in that space. So in energy, the one that we like the most is Oil Search. And the one that we're less compelled to own, but which is still quite large in the sector, is Woodside. Both of these companies have a base business that is producing, and then both of them have project approvals that are coming up in the near term. So you can take a view as to whether Oil Search is going to get its projects away or whether Woodside is going to get its ones approved. Even if you assume both of them get approved and both of them kind of bring those new projects into their cash flows over the next several years, the materiality of Oil Search's projects in Papua New Guinea is much greater to the base business than what Woodside is looking at. So mathematically, there's a bigger upside for Oil Search with its PNG assets than what you see with Woodside with its West Australian assets. And then longer term, when you look further out, we see a more natural path of growth for Oil Search in bringing future projects. You know, when you think about the more medium and long-term horizon, there are future projects in Papua New Guinea, and their Alaska acreage is also quite exciting. So we think that there's more growth and more optionality in Oil Search, and yet the valuation there is not terribly demanding.
That's a really fascinating perspective. I've not heard anybody express their view on construction like that before. Also, looking again at some of the assets in your portfolio, I saw that you have several positions related to overseas consumers, but more limited exposure to the Australian consumer. Could you talk us through some of those stocks and what it is you like about them?
Yeah, sure. So I work at Fidelity, and part of our heritage was Peter Lynch running the Magellan Fund in the US. And you can read his books. He was one of the great investors of the end of last century. And he always said that he loved a store rollout story. And you can see particularly why that would make sense in the US, where you can get a concept and you can prove it up in a couple of states, and then you can roll it out across 50 states. And so you can get 15, 20 years of growth. And that growth is really low risk, high quality growth, because you're doing something that you know how to do, and you're adding incremental amounts of capital year after year rather than, a big lump sum investment. So a store rollout story can be a great, great investment where the company just builds its value gradually year after year after year. If you try to put that into the Australian market, there's a bit of a problem. And that is, by the time you're large enough to list, you're probably about halfway through rolling out stores because our market is so small. So we have had some great store rollout stories in the past. 20 years ago, Harvey Norman was a store rollout story. 10 years ago, JB Hi-Fi was a store rollout story. Even today, you've got some formats like Smiggle under Premier. But by and large, there's not that many stories in the domestic consumer space where they've got that steady growth just from adding new stores. So most of them are now more mature formats where they're really just going to go up and down with sentiment on the Australian consumer. And at this point, that's very much linked to sentiment on the housing market. So again, with this idea that I don't want to put risk into the portfolio where it's just volatility or where it's macro risk, I really don't want to add a lot of exposure into the fund of stocks that are going to trade on this kind of macro view of Australian house prices up, Australian house prices down, because that is driven much more by sentiment than it is by the individual company fundamentals. So in an absence of great store rollout stories, I've really struggled in recent years to find compelling names in the domestic consumer space. But where we have seen opportunities is companies that are exposed overseas. And partly that's just because when you've got a business operating in a global market, the upside is, you know, the white space for them to conquer is just so much greater. So I jokingly say that Kate's rule of overseas investments is that when a company first starts going overseas, the market hates it and is convinced that management are going to lose money. But if the company demonstrates over time that they can make money, you know, make a decent return above the cost of capital in these overseas markets, then the market loves it because you've got a growth path so much bigger and longer and more sustainable than what you can get in just the small contained Aussie market. So the stocks that I like in the consumer space have these characteristics, and they're Lovisa and Treasury Wine. So Lovisa, costume jewelry stores. So not diamonds, but just small ticket size jewelry items that you wear for a night out or for the day at the races. And they are rolling out stores, but not just in Australia, but they're rolling out stores in Europe and in the US. And so now they're in that Peter Lynch territory of many, many years of just incrementally rolling out new store after new store after new store. And that means that their growth is going to be less driven by interest rates up, interest rates down, consumer sentiment up, consumer sentiment down, and more just by the mathematics of rolling out store after store through time in these new geographies. Now, we initially bought in when the market had lost faith in the overseas expansion. The market is now a bit more comfortable with it, so the shares have performed quite well, but we still think that you'll have many years of future growth coming through, and that this is, therefore a great kind of low-risk form of growth in the consumer space over many years, not just over, a few months while everyone is excited about a housing market recovery. Similarly, Treasury Wine, Treasury Wine going back several years was a really troubled company. It was really just an agricultural company and exposed to the vagaries of, whether it rained, whether it was dry, whether there was a good harvest or a bad harvest, enormously volatile working capital cycles and a troubled balance sheet. And so it was a really, an almost uninvestable company. If you go back several years, the company has been making really significant changes to move itself downstream, to go from being an upstream agricultural company, all about growing grapes, and downstream to being a consumer branded company, all about managing brands that consumers like. So in doing so, it's upended the global wine industry in two really profound ways. One is, it is decoupling where the grapes are grown from what the branding is. And that's a big difference, because it used to be that if you buy into a Penfolds wine, then you knew that the grapes were going to be grown in South Australia. Now the company is showing that it can take that Penfolds brand and it can apply it to grapes grown in other regions around the world. And so it's expanding out and decoupling the brand from that upstream agricultural volatility and creating much stronger brands, much broader brands. It used to be if Penfolds is just about grapes grown in South Australia, there's only so many grapes you're going to grow, so that brand is pretty limited. Now, if you can take that and put that across grapes grown in Northern California, grapes grown in France, then you're going to be able to extend that brand and make it a lot larger and powerful and unlock a lot more supply to meet the growing demand. That's one change. The second change that the company has been doing is in its distribution. It is getting a lot closer to its companies. It is cutting out layers and layers of middlemen, which is really letting it control its destiny a lot more. So companies have tended to be passive upstream producers who then, passively put their wine up. Distributors come in and take it on and then negotiate with retailers. And so all of their kind of brand building and promotion, it all comes from the distributors and the retailers. So you're at their mercy. Treasury has upended that, cut out a lot of the distributors, and is going direct, especially into large growing markets like China, which is giving it more margin and more control and more stability. It's becoming much more the master of its own destiny, and again, completing that shift from being a volatile upstream agricultural company to being a steady, growing downstream consumer branded company. So, we find both of those stories, Lovisa and Treasury Wine, much more compelling than domestic consumer names, which are much more limited in their growth potential within Australia.
I'm glad that you mentioned Peter Lynch there. He's absolutely one of my investing heroes, and I never miss an opportunity to give a plug to his book, One Up on Wall Street. I always, whenever somebody says to me, oh, I'm interested in learning about investing and how you go about it, it's always one of my top recommendations.
Yeah, I agree.
But look, I've got three favorite questions that I like to ask every one of my guests. I'm aware that we're running a little bit short on time, so we'll try and keep these brief, but I would love to hear your take on them. First of all, could you share something with us recently that you've read? It could be an article, a book, could be a piece of research, and you know what? It could even be a podcast if that's your thing, that really impressed you or really blew you away or you really learned something valuable from.
Yeah, so I recently watched the Netflix series Inside Bill's Brain. It's three episodes about Bill Gates. And the one that really amazed me was the third episode where it talks about the founding of a company called TerraPower. And TerraPower was Bill Gates getting together the best minds that he could find to try to find a better design for a nuclear reactor. And they came up with one. It's called Traveling Wave Reactor. And astonishingly, this is a nuclear reactor that runs on nuclear waste and that is not susceptible to meltdowns. So it doesn't have the safety issues that today's and yesterday's nuclear reactors do. So basically we have something that could make a profound difference in a world that is trying to transition away from carbon-generated power. They got close to doing a pilot plant in China, and then the new technology transfer ban under the Trump administration meant that they couldn't go ahead with that. So inspiring and also so frustrating that there's this great technology that's been developed and yet we don't seem to be able to bring it on stream.
Very frustrating indeed. You're not the first person who I've heard recommend that. I really need to get around to watching it sooner rather than later. But if you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give your younger self a single piece of investing advice, what would it be?
Well, like the honest answer is there, I would just tell myself, when this company emerges called Google, just buy it.
That's the honest answer.
That would be the real answer, right? Okay, if I don't have the benefit of perfect foresight, I think the answer is if you're going to invest, you've got to be somewhat obsessive because the only way to spot mispriced opportunities is to be accumulating a lot of information and spotting inconsistencies in it. So, be obsessive and devote your spare time to it, or give your money to someone who is obsessive and is going to do that on your behalf.
One more question for you, but before I ask it, I always like to insert a little bit of a disclaimer. Don't try this at home. We're not actually suggesting to anybody that you go out there and put all of your money in a stock and forget about it. This is supposed to be a bit of an exercise in long-term thinking and hopefully a little bit of fun. So with that being said, if the markets were going to be closed for the next 5 years, starting from tomorrow, and you could only own shares in a single company, what would it be?
Yeah, it is an interesting question. And I think if you really take that question at face value, you need to focus on return of capital, not return on capital. So your first question needs to be, which company am I convinced is going to be around in 5 years? to still, you know, be trading when the markets reopen. So I'm gonna go a bit conservative here, and I'm gonna go with a stock that has been a winner for over 20 years, and that's Goodman Group. And it's a industrial property company, well loved by the market, a little bit off its highs now. But the benefit that it's got is if interest rates continue to go down, and we still live in this lower for longer world, then the property value will continue to inflate. If all of that reverses and we somehow move into a world of inflation, Goodman is one of the few businesses where its rents, all of its rental contracts, are set with 3.5% escalation every year, or the minimum of that, or inflation. So if you get a tick up in inflation, then Goodman kind of wins either way. I think even though it's large in the Australian context, it's still small on the global scale and has plenty of space to grow and continue with its geographic rollout. So I'm pretty confident that 5 years down the track, company's still going to be operating and able to give me a return of capital and a return on capital.
Great. Well, Kate, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today and for sharing some insights into how you think and invest.
Great. My pleasure. Thank you.